Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on November 5th, 2024, and time to reconvene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Steve Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our General Counsel, Alfred Morrison, Member of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, is absent today. Please mute or turn off your cell phone or other electronic devices at this time. This session is for the board and the CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. Our next agenda item is item two, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. Good morning, John.
Good morning, commissioners. First up is our media update and Aaron Swaney. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. Good morning, John.
Morning.
Pretty exciting day today. We got a little bit of a different vibe going on, so it should be fun. So we'll jump right into it. We want to talk a little bit about our 75th anniversary. We've had a full year of activities going on, you know, celebrating 75 years as a PUD, talking about public power in many different ways. It's been a real huge success. So just kind of wanted to wrap that up and talk a little bit about all the things that we did and give a few shout outs to the folks. So a lot of the work started about a year ago, kind of planning for what we were going to do for 75th. Kelsey, first off, really created an amazing graphic that, or a logo that we were really proud of that we put on a lot of different things. I'm sure you can see them on shirts and all over the place. So just want to give Kelsey a big shout out for that. And we also had, you know, everybody from the communications department really pitched in on this one. We had write-ups throughout going over the decades, going over PUD pioneers, talking about ex-commissioners, talking about people who have changed the PUD and really stepped up and did amazing things. David wrote most of those and did a great job. We went through all of our archive photos and just really did a deep dive on that and printed a lot of them on the website and used a lot of them in our communications to customers, as you can see on the wire. We used some in Current. So it was just kind of one of those things, kind of an all hands on deck. Everybody came together and did a great job. So this is why I'm so excited today. So we've got every month throughout the year, we were giving away $75 bill credits to customers who had to go to our website. They had to go and sign up and actually enter. First month we did it, we got almost 5,500 folks that came and entered. Overall, we got more than 24,000 entries. We had 35,000 visits to our website just for folks that were going and checking this out. We decided that to kind of culminate with Public Power Week and culminate with our last, our actual anniversary, which was September 1st, we would do a $750 bill credit. And Peter Bell from Snohomish was the winner of that bill credit. And Peter's actually here today, so we wanted to present him with an actual check and give that to him and have you guys, commissioners, come up if you would please do and take a photo with Peter. And John, if you could do that as well. I should say Wendy, I left Wendy off. Oh, I should have met Krista as well. But Wendy did a ton for designing the website.
Thank you.
Yeah. Designing this giant check.
Congrats. Happy for you.
What lovely surprise.
So you want us facing you?
Just facing me, kind of like our normal kind of setup for our EOMs.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
Can this check actually be cashed?
I think he already has the bill credit on. He's
going to have to endorse it.
Yeah, just a little bit closer there if you can. Awesome. Fantastic looking here, y'all. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I don't know if you have children or not, but when I was a kid, my parents were always like, if you're not in the room, turn the lights off.
Yep.
So are you going to suspend that for a while?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
No, I will note that it hasn't really gotten through to them.
Yeah.
My wife's not quite as a stalwart with that. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you for
it. To all electric yet?
I have. I have a ground source heat pump and I have an air source and a water heater heat pump that I bought through the PUD program.
I'm so proud of you and happy new one.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to come this morning.
My pleasure.
Yeah,
at least I could do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
All right.
All right.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I will just say it was a lot of fun to be able to give Peter a call and let him know he had won. And I think I ate up a little bit too much of his time in the morning. We got to chatting. He actually lives out where I, in the Malton area, close to where I mountain bike. In fact, in the neighborhood that I think is right next door. So opportunity, I may be able to get to see Peter in the future when I'm up there. And maybe he can even rescue me when I fall off my bike. And
go on the unofficial trails, he might end up in my backyard.
I'll try to stay on the official trails.
That's great.
Thank you, everybody. All right, just some media coverage. We did have, just really quickly, you did have some media coverage from the storms yesterday. I think we had about 25,000, 30,000 outages yesterday. Obviously, Herald reached out and Cairo reached out and spoke and with that. But one tool that we really, we used that broadcast messaging tool again. And it was just, we got really good feedback from customer service and from some of the other groups that, you know, customers are really, really enjoying that tool.
So broadcasting, we pushed it out to them.
Yeah, so it's a messaging tool that we're able to post a message not only to the outage map, but anybody who signs up for text messages also gets those messages. Oh, right. And we can target it to regions, so we can target it to like yesterday where the Northwest region was really getting hit hard. So yeah, it's a really, really valuable tool.
But can they still only sign up once they have an outage and report it, or can they sign it? Okay.
Yeah, right now they're still got the outage that they have to sign up for text.
Thank you.
So really, this is Adam Cornelius did a really good job. He's working on a working group with a bunch of other Southwest and Northwest utilities talking about the Markets Plus, EDAM, and going through that process. And they just issued one of their briefs that was picked up by the media. Adam was interviewed by Clearing Up, interviewed by RTO Insider. They did a couple of stories on that. I think it just shows a lot of the diligence and the work that's going into this effort and making sure that you know, top T's are crossed and I's are dotted.
Yeah, I thought it was a good piece.
Yeah.
Again, it also just shows, one, we have exceptionally talented folks, and the region realizes that. And it our influence, or another example of our influence, you know, on a really significant effort like the markets, the day-ahead markets. And it also demonstrates how we push way above our weight. I mean, we're not really a player, especially going forward, being load following as we convert to load following. But we have somebody, and more than just Adam, Joe Fina is involved and others involved, and really making a significant impact on what will be the future of power supply around the West.
Yeah, I also just think it's powerful when a worker, when we put a spotlight on worker bee, and a worker bee, it's that the expert on whatever it is, whether it's something like this or our own system, gets to talk about it. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah,
this it doesn't feel like, I don't know, I wouldn't say as much comm shop, but it just, I think it's a
100%. This was Adam.
It's a perfect way to do it.
Yeah, working on that group and come together. I think this was, they were taking turns that it was going to be Lee's time that Adam was, but
yeah.
I think it really turned out well. And like to John's point, really shows the amazing work and the amazing people we have working on
here.
So, for the naturally skeptical people out there who read this, I guess they might ask, well, what about the negatives? So it focuses on the positives. Are there any negatives? And so I don't know if your coverage is including any potential concerns.
For Markets Plus?
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, I've seen some of those stories that have been out there, and we're trying to include those in news links and some of these other areas where it's getting kind of more kind of coverage, and our employees are seeing that. I think this story was really focused on the positives of the clean energy resources that could come from Markets Plus. And that's what that issue paper was really talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
We rebranded Community Energy Fund in September, put out a press release on that, and that was picked up by a few publications. We also wrote our Herald column talking about that rebrand and talking about Run for Warmth. Supporting Community Energy Fund. The October Wire was also focused on Community Energy Fund. So getting that word out, More and more wherever we can. And then also into 2025, we're going to have a comm plan really talking more about community energy fund and how customers can help along. And then we had a nice write-up in the APPA Public Power Daily by Paul Ciamboli, wrote up about Councilman Nearing's visit to us at the meeting last month, talking about the microgrid exhibit and all the work that went into that. The project will also be featured in the December. And finally, just wanted to show you the wire for November. We really talked about emergency preparedness. We overhauled, Wendy overhauled the website that goes into talking about how folks can be prepared, how they can build an emergency kit, how they can make a backup plan. So we really wanted to highlight that with the November wire and push people to the website. We also talked about SnowSmart, and we have Power Talks coming up in December. Should be fun.
What is that zip as the one for glasses? Zap.
Yeah, no.
Zap. 50-50 shot. I'm trying to memorize it. Yeah, okay.
That's it for me.
Any questions for her?
No more. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. And just again, a really quick note that communication department and other, but primarily the communication department and how they have really highlighted 75th anniversary throughout the year and really made it a big deal, made it special. And just a huge kudos to a team that blew it out of water on something that could have just been kind of a normal routine type of celebration. And I think we get a lot of, build a lot of goodwill within our communities and with our customers as we highlight that kind of thing.
John, when did the water department get formed? Wasn't it before 1949?
Yeah. We celebrated the water department's 75th a couple of years ago.
I'm trying to remember the date.
We love the water department.
Yes, Jeff Kallstrom, Chief Water Operations Officer. The water utility was formed in 1948, so 1 year ahead. So in 2023, we had the 75th celebration for the water utility.
So we're really 77 years old.
Is that true?
A 75 is a nice round number.
As an overall PUD, yeah, 77. Yeah. Electric specifically, 75.
Yeah. It's just a function of took more time to acquire and begin operating the electrical grid in the area as opposed to taking over the action pumps for the water system.
Well, I was barely born, of course. But, I in my mind, the water is part of the PUD.
Yeah.
It's not really, it's a different line of business.
Yeah.
But anyway, I celebrate 77.
Yes. Well, so we are the water utility is very thankful to be a part of the overall PUD, and we leverage a lot of the thinking and the talent that exists within the PUD as a whole, and that makes our service to water customers that much better because we have access to those resources that other systems may not have.
Thanks for speaking to the issue.
Yeah.
And just to take on to John, your comments, we're just hitting out of the ballpark in social media, getting the word out again during outages, again, all times of the day. And then we've also done a great job, I don't know if we're doing it or they're just picking it up, but a lot of the online newspapers, which I had never really been on my radar. I think Bloomwood has one, Edmonds has one, a lot of our work gets up to those and not the Herald. So yeah. It's really nice to see the spectrum.
Yes. Yeah. All right, next up is a surplus and sale of stormwater easement across district property and Green Barns. Morning, Green.
Good morning and happy election day. So this is for the surplus and sale of a stormwater easement across district property. The purpose of the presentation is to inform the board of the upcoming request to declare surplus a portion of district fee-owned property in Linwood and allow for the sale of an easement to JM1 Holdings. Answer any questions regarding the transaction and to let you know that the easement document will be brought to commission for a public hearing and vote by resolution at the November 19th, 2024 commission meeting. Give you a little bit of background. JM1 Holdings is in the process of developing a 27-lot plat called Westwood Estates, adjacent to the district's fee-owned Swamp Creek to Clearview transmission line right-of-way. The stormwater easement is needed in order to disperse stormwater such that it doesn't flow across the district's maintenance road. And I wanted to, sorry, I have to change glasses. And I wanted to point out that currently the stormwater follows a natural path across the PUD right-of-way, which is not currently significant as there's no impervious roads or structures. Snohomish County requires following this natural path or the drainage will increase when roads and homes are built. The closed pipe will convey the stormwater across the right-of-way and continue the natural drainage to the creek and stream system, which currently exists. As you can see here, I know there was a question about 6th Avenue West. Right where the gate is, where I've got the circle, that little road is 6th Avenue West, and it is a newly built road, which gives access to the North Creek West subdivision, the very south of that. It connects 184th Street Southwest with 186th Place Southwest and crosses our right-of-way and currently leaves it open to vehicle access. And a gate will be put in there by JM1 Holdings. The proposed easement is 20 feet wide, 10 feet on either side of the center line, and it consists of approximately 4,000 square feet. We did an in-house appraisal, which determined the value at approximately $5,400. JM1 Holdings will be placing a gate at 6th Avenue West to impede trespassing, as well as adding gravel to the maintenance road in order to improve access. No district equipment, facilities, or access will be impacted. District staff have reviewed and approved the request. Additionally, we will be fully indemnified and bear no liability in the future maintenance of the equipment. And on November 19th, commission will hold a public hearing and vote on this resolution. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
That question that I had about where does the stormwater go now?
Mm-hmm. It goes there right now. It flows there. But right now it's all vacant land. So it doesn't hurt our access whatsoever. But once they get the buildings and the road, then that's going to be a lot more runoff.
Well, I think it's a good thing because I used to teach in that high school.
Mm-hmm.
And those athletic fields can get flooded.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, sometimes they do. Mm-hmm. And so I'm happy to see that that's going to be contained and not flooding.
Exactly, yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Emery, we'll have a key to the gate.
Absolutely.
Okay. And the amount you think we will actually receive, the $5,400, you expect that we...
Yes.
Good.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you
for
your work on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen.
Thanks.
Next up is our cost of service analysis, the COSA. Christina Lineweber and Peter Donauer. I think Peter's going to kick us off.
All right. Good morning. Peter Donauer, Senior Manager of Rates Economics and Energy Risk Management. John said, joined by Christina Lineweber, our rates expert here in the departments. And we're going to talk a bit about the cost of service analysis, the theory and the process that we go through today. So purpose of the presentation is to provide some of the background on this COSA and how we use this in electric rate making. And this is informational only. So we do have some upcoming meetings. We're on track with what's happening here. We have we've had our budget public hearing on October 7th today. We're going to talk about COSA theory. In 2 weeks, we're going to come back on the 19th and present the rate package details, followed by the open public hearing. And then we're going to be requesting commission approval of rates on December 17th, getting it all in by the end of the year. This would lead to rates being effective on April 1st, 2025, which is our normal timeline. So for today, we're going to talk about the COSA workshops, our rate guidance and philosophy that we developed this year. We're going to then go into the cost of service COSA theory and background, and then talk about next steps. And before we get into that, I just want to mention a couple of other rates packages going on, just because we're going to be coming back to you quite a bit this quarter. And so just as a way of disambiguation of what's going on here, we've got two separate rates packages that we're going to be presenting. The first one, including today, is the 2025 through 2029 revenue adjustment. This part is just about theory and process. So it's some background information. We're going to come back, as I said, in a couple of weeks and provide the preliminary results and the adjustments that we're recommending for 2025 through 2029. We've also got another package which involves two items. One is a permanent net billing rate. And the second item is a request for an extension for the pilot CNI time of day. And that briefing will be on 11/19, and we'll talk about the specific timeline with those as we get to that briefing. So I did want to mention, in 2024, the staff and ELT went through a process that involved four workshops. And the goal was to build general knowledge around what the cost of service is, what the process cost of service analysis process is, and what the process is itself, and to come to a consensus on the district philosophy. And this involved some of the items here that I've listed. But you can see, starting in April, July, August, September, we had four workshops talking about COSA standards, COSA process, and industry norms. We then talked about legacy rate concepts and how changes in load patterns, what we've seen as far as over time. We then got into legacy rate priorities and talked again about advanced rate designs and other related issues to some of the newer rates that are out there. And so the outcome was a rates guidance plan. And to summarize this, these are some of the key principles that came out of that. These are, again, in alignment with standards and utility standards, but alignment with the utility cost drivers is one key idea. It's that we want to adjust all rate classes to within plus or minus 5% of what the COSA indicator rate levels are. We also want to see that there's flexibility in this plan, so that we can allow for some more significant increases for rate classes that are more significantly out of step with costs, but also that we can tailor the recommendations so that they're gradual. So we do kind of look at that, how we can make these adjustments over a 5-year window rather than just overnight, to make sure that we can reach those targets over 5 years, but we can also prioritize some of the adjustments in the near term in particular. So with those ideas in mind, I think some of the presentation today is going to kind of cover some of those topics at a high level. But this kind of gives you a sense of, just how much time we spent together working on this. And I think as a team, we were pretty satisfied with where we landed there. And just to talk about a little bit about what the annual process is, one bit of feedback we got from last year too was how can we bring the revenue adjustments to the commission, to the ELT, and basically get the process going sooner so that we can make these decisions with a little bit more time. And so just to talk a little bit about what the process has entailed, and just to also point out that it's ongoing, continuous improvement as we try to you know, meet that objective there. But it starts with the budgeting process. This is ongoing now, but it started way back in June. And these are identifying our long-term financial goals, looking at financial strategies that can be used, such as rates included. But they result in a budget proposal. And then this comes to the COSA as a revenue target. COSA modeling can then occur after that, where it is an iterative process. But Christina will talk in some more detail about it. But this is the part where we take those costs and that budget revenue target, and we functionalize those costs, classify them, we allocate those costs to different customer classes and specific components, of the rate designs themselves. Then we come back with a recommendation where we're capturing stakeholder inputs. This is the iterative bit, and we implement our guidance principles to meet those timing and alignment objectives that we've established. And then finally, we have Q1 of 2025 after the rates are approved, where there's programming that happens. There's testing, extensive testing to make sure that when we do implement those bills, they come out right. We're always aiming for 100% of the time, but as often as possible. And we implement that go live typically on April 1st after all that testing is done, and then customers start seeing those bills. So that's the general process. And like I said, we're always trying to improve and make that more efficient. And so at this point, I think I'm going to hand it over to Christina to talk a little bit about the cost service analysis background.
And just to add to a little bit to Peter's comments, if you recall, when we went through this process last year, it really has not, and more historically, has not been synced up with the budget process. So we had a couple different goals throughout this year. One is to go through the workshops, do the analysis, take a deep dive, make sure we are all in sync on is the COSA aligning with best practices and fundamental principles? And then how do we incorporate that into the budget conversations, budget discussions? And also using a kind of a 5-year look ahead, both from a revenue adjustment as well as the cost, you know, from a cost side on the budget. And this really has, and again, huge credit to Peter and Christina for, conducting and facilitating all the workshops, all the questions that we had. It was a pretty significant lift, but I'm much happier with where we are now. And as Peter said, we're trying to continuously improve, but we're in a much better place to have the overall view of what the future looks like from a cost perspective, budget perspective, as well as revenue adjustments and or making sure that we are recovering our costs appropriately.
I am very pleased to see that this is being done before I retire. I really am, because I've been pleased to see that this is happening, because I think people, many people, many of our classes are not paying their fair share. Maybe it's not my call, it's more yours. So I look forward to all of the information.
Thank you. So we'll dive right in here. This workshop is called Cost of Service Theory and Practice. So what is a cost of service? That's the first question that we have to answer. And the cost of service is a quantitative exercise that answers the question, who causes the utility to incur this cost? And this is the starting point for all of our other discussions about rates and prices at the utility. The next question that comes out of this is therefore, why? Why do we make the cost of service our starting point, and where does this come from? And this comes from the 100 plus years of regulatory history of rate making in the United States. It starts at a very high level, and it starts at the legal level as a public body, as a regulated body. And what the lawyers tell us is that Rates need to be fair, just, reasonable, and non-discriminatory. And what does that mean? Well, non-discriminatory is perhaps the easiest one to get your head around. That means that we can't set rates based on whether we like the customer or the industry that they're in. If we make a distinction between customers or rate classes, it has to be based on their electric usage and their patterns, not on we don't like this customer class or we don't like that industry. Okay. The other three are a little more in the eye of the beholder. Fair, just, and reasonable. People have some different ideas. Honest people have some very different ideas about what is fair and just and reasonable. And so that's where the idea of cost causation comes in. It comes from the idea that it is fair, just, and reasonable to ask customer classes to pay for the costs that they have caused. But of course, cost causation does not exist in a vacuum. And there's also some very practical things that the industry has found out through the years. So there needs to be, in order to just run the utility and charge the rates, there needs to be a certain amount of stability in our cash flows and our revenues. There needs to be economic efficiency as a public body. There needs to be equity, as we said before. There needs to be bill stability and customer acceptance and customer understanding. You could make a rate that's very much cost-driven that is so complicated that nobody could ever understand it. And that's not good. So you have to balance, once you've set that floor of cost causation, you need to balance these other very practical things in setting rates. And then finally, each utility has to look at their own situation, not just to answer the question of which of their own customers are causing the costs, but also to ask, what is unique about our service territory and our power supply, our distribution system, our geography, our customer base, that we need to take consideration when we're making rates that meet all of these principles? There's going to be...
Looking back on that slide, is there an RCW that we should know about that...
There are RCWs. I look over to the lawyers.
The one about how we do this. And what is it?
It's the one that created us.
But as far as how we divide cost among rate different rate payers, is there an RCW that?
No. So this is where the concept of fair, just, reasonable, non-discriminatory comes in, and then you set that based on those principles.
I understand. Okay. Thank you.
Something that occurs to me is there's discussion about not our PUD, but other PUDs in Washington that are having to meet the increased cost to accommodate data centers. So if we had that, we cannot discriminate against them. But there are people who are saying, well, this is maybe a little off topic, I hope not, but if we had the data centers here, we can't discriminate against them.
We can't discriminate at them because we don't like them, but we can certainly say a data center has a certain usage pattern, and if that usage pattern is having a cost causation, then we can be asked them to pay the costs.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, there's going to be several threes today in the presentation, and the first three here is this, the three big stages in setting rates and in rate making. And the first stage of rate making is the revenue requirement. And this asks the question, how much money does the utility need? It primarily comes from the budget. And it's how big is the pie? What is in the pie? So we look at our customer behavior and our loads for a lot of this, asking how much power we're going to need, how much revenue we think we're going to get in at current rates. We also look at other things like our materials costs, our labor costs. We've talked about those throughout this, last year, this year, the whole budget process. And we look at our projected expenses and we compare them with our forecasted revenues at the current rates. And if there's a difference, that signals the need for a rate adjustment. And you've seen here from this, we stole the slide, shamelessly stealing from the hard work of the budget department. of what kind of things that we're seeing in the budget drivers this year that all get ported right into the cost of service. And then it comes to the meat of today's discussion, which is who pays what? Now that we've got the pie, we've got to slice up the pie and see how much each customer class is driving and causing. And we have here are the eaters of the pie, all the customer classes that we are looking at to divide and see which are causing each class. So our biggest class is our residential class. That's about 2/3 roughly of our retail revenue. So we're not, you know, certainly a large driver. Nothing is going to happen without the retail class since it's such a overwhelming majority. And then the next 20 to 30% are our two general service classes. We break those up based on size. So we have a small general class, which is under 100 kilowatt hours of our peak energy demand. And that's going to be small commercial properties that don't have a lot of special equipment. So like little boutique shops, banks, churches, that kind of thing. Then we have the medium general class, which is going to be commercial properties that are still on the distribution system, but are either very large in footprint or have lots of equipment, like a grocery store or a hotel or even a light industrial kind of facility. Then we have, which is about 5% of our load, is the industrial class. And this is different from the medium general class in that it's taking its power at the transmission level voltage. And then we have three special classes that are less than 1% of the total load. We have street and traffic lighting that is paid for by our municipalities and our neighborhoods for street and traffic lighting, for example. We have the special continuous load. This is a very tiny class for the attachments people put on our poles, like Comcast or Verizon or those kind of people, to have cell signals and wireless boosters and this kind of thing. And then we have our legacy time of use rate. This is actually more of a seasonal rate than a time of use rate, but it's our smallest class. And we'll discuss that more in a future presentation.
Chris, can you back on that or this slide? So we have seven classes. Is this typical for utilities? Do some have more? Do they divide some generals and large up? Finer or less fine, or what are your thoughts about whether we've got the appropriate?
What we have is pretty reasonable for a public utility. A lot of IOUs, investor-owned utilities, will have scads of classes upon classes. One of the things that I am looking forward to personally as a practitioner of cost of service when we get our AMI data is the ability to answer that question more quantitatively, because we'll be able to have more granular data about the dispersion of customers within each class. Right now, just that monthly snapshot from the billing, it provides some information, but it's really hard to maybe look within the class and see how they're different. And so that we may come to you in the future with proposals to consolidate or divide classes once we have that ability to really look inside the class.
And thoughts on why some IOUs have more classes?
They tend to be bigger. They tend to have been a little further on the early adoption of AMI. So they've got more options as well. They're also, some of the ways they're regulated, they're required to do certain load research on the types of classes and make different divisions.
And I think it also has something to do, you would know better than I would, but they get a return on capital.
Yes.
And that capital is actually allocated to different customer classes, depreciation rates, and all kinds of different things.
They haven't sent, that was part, yeah, and part of that goes back to why they were early adopters of AMI, is because they're getting certain returns on that, in ways that we, you know.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
So here's our second three of today, which is the three phases of the cost of service analysis. The first phase is functionalization, and that's taking the costs that we've got out of the budget and translating them into their function in the utility. So when you looked at the budget, it's often divided by what a thing is. So is it labor, or is it materials, or is it external contracts? Those kinds of things. In the cost of service world, we don't care what it is, we care why it is. And so whether it's a person or a material or a contract, why are we doing that thing? Is it part of producing or purchasing power? Is it part of transmitting power? Is it part of doing all of our customer service work? Why? And so each of those costs are reallocated to one of these buckets in why, in the functionalization stage. The second stage is the classification stage, which asks the question of what aspects of a customer's usage or existence in the system drives those costs. So there's three main drivers here. One is demand, which is the peak usage either for the month or the year that the customer has, right? So how big is the pipe? What is that maximum throughput we need to do? Second is energy, which is the total usage. You may use a lot of energy for a very short time or a little bit of energy for a long time, but have the same total usage, and that's energy. And then there's a lot of stuff that is invariant to usage. The classic example to this is postage on bills, something that is just incurred because you exist as a customer on a system. And so each of those functionalized costs are then further subdivided by what is driving them. And finally, you compare that classification of what is driving them to the aspects of the class. So how much does that class contribute to the peak? How much does that class contribute to the energy? And how much does that class contribute to those fixed costs? And from that, you get a giant spreadsheet. The cost of service right now has 43 tabs. And so this is a very simplified version of the cost of service analysis. You'll see I've combined the classes and so forth, but these are real numbers in the simplified combined buckets of functionalization, classification, and allocation. Any questions so far? So now the big reveal. We need drum roll, please. The results. Here we see something that should not necessarily, if you remember the past cost of service analysis, not a huge surprise here. We have, as a system increase, as we know from the budget, of 4.6. But we have, as we learned last year doing the cost of service, behind hand a little bit on the residential class, and we're still showing that. Nothing has changed too much with our cost or our loads to change that. Then we've got a little bit ahead of ourselves with the commercial classes. Again, a little behind on the industrial large primary class. And then these, same directionally for lighting, continuous, and time of use. The percents on this are a bit funny, because it's such a small base. You add $1,000 and you get 10 more percentage points. But on a dollar basis, pretty close to last time in direction as far as indicating it in a increase for lighting and continuous and less for the time of use. So those are the results. And the next step will be, and we're currently in the process of speaking with management here at the utility about adding all those factors that we talked about back at the beginning of the presentation and things that Peter talked about. The gradualism, the desire to get to cost of service over the next hopefully 5 years, some of the strategic priorities of the district to bring you hopefully next time a plan for this year and then the future years of how we will get there in a gradual and studied way. And then what that will look like when it's translated into actual prices as far as customer charge, energy charge, and demand charge. So do we have, do we have any questions?
Yeah, I have to say, I love this. You are here. I mean, as if we didn't know that. But if you could go back one slide. Okay. So the ones that will be decreased will be general medium and general small.
Well, we may not present a decrease to you. It's fairly rare for utilities to actually do decreases.
What do those minuses mean?
Usually it would mean that we could support a decrease from the cost of service. We could support a decrease in those rates. What's more common for utilities to do is to just not change them. And if you'll remember last year, the time of use rate, we did not change it. We just left it alone. And you can see it is closer to cost of service than it was last time. Again, it's small dollar values and all that, but that would be probably more what we would recommend than actually implementing a decrease.
Okay, so in those two classes, categories, I was just trying to use logic and wondering the why are they, and I was thinking in both cases, you have banks and churches and other places that are closed much of the week, many hours of the week. So does that mean because their usage is less than?
The usage will drive the cost of service, definitely. But I wouldn't say necessarily that's the cause of these disparities. I'd say it's probably more due to the fact that, we didn't have a lot of rate increases for a couple of years between 2017 and I believe it was 2022. The cost of service was not necessarily performed every year. There also can be strategic reasons to not put all the increases, particularly on the residential class, because there are a lot of vulnerable customers in the residential class. So there becomes other public policy questions about where you should put the increase.
Opinions on this.
No, I just wanted to add, I mean, this is one of the reasons why we established the rates guidance planning and talked about those philosophies that we can get there, but we will get there. That's what we came to conclusions on. I think that this is really what we're, trying to figure out right now exactly what the strategy is. But when it comes to those negative percentages, I mean, we know that as part of that plan, we're not going to actually have a negative rate increase or a rate brief. Otherwise known, yes. That's what we're hoping to share with you that when we come back to you, if I can ask for that time.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions, though?
I have a lot of questions. I guess, first of all, if you can go back to the slide of the how the allocation works, the 46 tabs. I know I asked some of these questions last time we talked about this, and so my memory may be a little, but it seems like our residential customers, well, I think about as the owners, I don't believe in the big box stores and such as the owners, they are throughout the entire distribution system.
Okay.
And we have some parts of our area, low density, rural, that have to be very disproportionately expensive to maintain. And my concern is, are the other classes paying for that part of the distribution system? I know there's not a big box store out at the end of a single line feeder, but it just seems like it's sort of the public power way that we bring everybody in, whether they're easy to serve or hard to serve, and we charge them the same rate.
Yes.
Residential. And I understand this logic, and I read the 100-year-old thing a few years ago. That's very famous how we do all this. So I'm curious about, does everyone pay equally for the distribution system, or is it adjusted by the businesses that use different parts of the distribution system?
It is, the distribution system is classified and allocated based on the different customer classes' usage. So everyone within the class is paying the same share within the distribution system. So if you're a resident that's like right close to the substation, like me, I live in an apartment that is about four blocks from the substation that serves me, right? Versus someone who lives out in the middle of nowhere. So within the class, yes, I would theoretically, I'm using four blocks of distribution infrastructure. Somebody else who lives in a rural area might be using 10 miles of distribution infrastructure. We're both in the resident class, we're both paying the same rate. Now, between classes, we do use their other characteristics, their demand characteristics, the customer counts, various other of those classifiers to divide those distribution costs between the accounts. So based on how much each class on average is using of the system, it is weighted. The desire, I don't know what happened necessarily in rates in the past and why certain decisions were made, but the reason we may be having a little more off in the residential class than in the commercial classes maybe have been a past desire to help some of those residential customers who maybe, they're 2/3 of our system, virtual. So no cost of service is not going to touch the residential class at 2/3 of our system. And there may be been a desire to help those customers.
Yeah, it just seems that the challenge for the residential class that they have a small divider, they don't use that much electricity,
mm-hmm.
and they use virtually every part of the system. And I guess it doesn't bother me that the residential class is underpaying. I understand the logic of not. We wouldn't have a public power system if it wasn't for the residential class. They're the ones that voted to have it. And we would all be paying more because we would be under an IOU, including the big box stores and other type of things. So can you talk about what if the commission made a conscious decision to cap that 10.2% at some amount and live with it like that, and how that's deleterious to the organization, or what are your thoughts on that? Do utilities make a conscious decision to do that?
Yes, utilities do make conscious decisions to cap increases over time. There's, again, that goes back to our questions about gradualism, maybe versus economic efficiency. So if we're sending price signals to our customers of, how their actions are incentivizing the utility, we want that. We want that. That's one of the reasons in future presentations, we're going to, beyond this quarter, talking about things like time of use and stuff, sending those signals. So we don't want rates to get too low where those signals aren't being sent. But you don't want to shock the residents. Probably a 10.2 in one go would be too much. And so slowly going towards cost causation as a goal would be very advisable. We don't want to go backward necessarily. We don't just want this to become 11 and 12 and 13. But certainly not doing it all in one step is well within something we would recommend.
So if the last result was 10.5, so mm-hmm. this one's 10.2, do you have a sense of the history over the last 10 years or so? Is it getting worse? Has it been getting better?
It was getting worse. It seems to have been getting worse. It's a little, the records are not great, The records are not great. It seems to have been slowly getting worse. There are some gaps in the cost of service record where it seems we did not do a cost of service for a number of years. So I'm not sure what was happening there. But it does seem like over maybe the last 10 years, we've sort of been moving away. And of course, you know, last year we did have an increase for the residential class that was somewhat above the system average, and that helped.
And I would just say, again, we don't have, or it sounds like we don't have great history, but assuming we did do COSAs in the past, it could be safe to assume that it was a conscious decision to allow a some small subsidization between rate classes and or how they built the model. And if there were differences, to your question, Commissioner Logan, and again, Christina can always answer these much better than I can. But if you take all of the distribution costs, distribution system costs, pull out the large that the large primary that are served on transmission, and you divide that whole number by the total number of customers, not just residential that may use a higher weighted average of the distribution system, that can change the numbers. Is that accurate, Christina?
Yes, and there are sometimes cost of service practitioners will choose allocators, knowing how they will affect different classes, and then some people and myself tend to want to not do that, just try to choose what I think is the best allocator, and then let you as the policymakers say, okay, you know, let's be a little more.
Right. And I think that's where, I mean, this was kind of the blocking and tackling of a COSA and getting us to a point where we can, through the next presentation, have the conversation around philosophy and the principles and what's the vision for where we want to get from a strategic standpoint, from a cost of service and allocations across the different rate classes. So these questions are spot on.
Can I add one?
Yes.
Extra thing. Peter Donauer, senior manager. So, you know, as Christina described, the COSA has a very detailed model, and you know, some of the things that we've been doing the last few years, bringing on the base charge, for example, will help with these kinds of misalignments. You know, we can always get more complicated with rates to allocate costs more directly. But these things come with a trade-off, and we're always trying to balance these things. Generally, our principle is let's focus on cost causation and do that as accurately as possible. And you know, we can look at some of the questions of, you know, whether or not that sort of range of plus or minus 5% is the, you know, appropriate level in the future. And I think that's a question, a sort of study question to come back, you know. Before committing to something that's higher than that, then or different from that, we should really study, okay, what does that mean really for us if we allow a large misalignment over a long period of time? What sort of signals and what sort of fairness does that you know, mean we have for all of our customers? We have to balance all those things. I think that there's a, you know, kind of balance between saying let's follow our principles and also let's study something that might be a little bit different, and then just make the sort of common sense improvements to the cost of service that you know, there's a lot going on under the hood that maybe don't mention, but Christina has been improving over time, and so every year we're going to sort of get the benefits of better a better model too, and improved modeling techniques.
Another question, Christine. I think when I asked last year, I asked you this question. I think I said, you know, if you think about a residential customer and a, like a boutique or a relatively small general medium customer, and what's the difference? And one of the things I think you, if I remember correctly, you said is their low, their usage profile is different. The residential is more costly for us. And so I'm wondering, is some of that because of electrification, because more people have electric heating, is this difference going to get worse because of something that is happening in that sector? is, yeah.
So the thing with the cost profile of a residential customer tends to go up in the morning when people get up. It peaks at, it is driving our system peak. So get up, our system peak tends to be 7, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning in the winter. And that's when every residential person is turning on, you know, turning, cooking breakfast, doing all those things. They're contributing a lot to that system peak. So if we go back to the big spreadsheet, you know, they're hitting a lot in that demand category, which is our peak, peak usage. The businesses, some of them, the early riser businesses are turning on early in the morning, preparing equipment and stuff. But a lot of businesses don't open until 10 or 11. And then maybe they close at 4 or 5. And so they're not hitting our either our morning peak or our evening peak. And those peak costs are driving a lot of our costs. So those get, a number of them get moved to the residential class. Now, for the residentials in particular, but and for the commercials as well, but, you know, in response to the question, when we bring in time of use rates, which is, we hope to be discussing with you in the first quarter of next year, knock on fake wood here, that will be a different way of showing price signals. And again, if all goes well, knock on wood, that will reduce those peak times and maybe cause a rebalancing or at least cause us to save costs as far as needed additional resources. But that's the thing with having such a heavy residential load and the way the residential load sort of maps onto our peaks, but also has that very different peak structure where it has the dual peaks in the morning and the evening versus the commercials, which tend to peak in the middle of the day.
So some of that cost to demand, I would guess, comes from the price of us buying electricity during those peaks. Mm-hmm. And I would guess some is having built a system that can handle the peaks. So on the first part, is that going to change with load following? Can we switch and do we know what that's going to do and what that's going to do to the COSA if we did this?
We do not. I am working on what that is going to do to the COSA. The load following has an energy and a demand component. I don't necessarily expect a ton of difference in the energy component. On the demand component, it sort of also feeds into how the people respond to our price signals that we're putting out. If we are able to lower our peak demand, our load following bill will be lower and the cost will be lower. So if time of use works, if any other information that we have used, our conservation programs, all of that, if that is able to lower peak demand, we will get less demand charges from Bonneville in the load following program, and that will go through to the COSA. If everybody decides they're going to pile on the grids, then we will have more costs. So that's where we're going with more interaction with our customers in the future. And the other unknown card, which you mentioned, is the electrification. As much as electrification makes people more efficient, especially with things like heat pumps, that will help that class because it'll shave off those everybody turns on their space heater in the morning, which I still have. I'm in an apartment. I don't have a heat pump. I have a space heater. I turned it on at 8 o'clock. I'm not helping the peak. But now EV load is the other thing. If everybody decides they're going to come home and plug in at like 6 o'clock in the night, that won't be good. Now, if they, I'm on my own personal load management program. I can't have my space heater and charge my car at the same time. It'll blow my fuse box. So I only charge at night. So as we can get other people on some sort of load management program with that, again, it might actually help. And that goes to this new world that we've discussed a lot in our workshops, and we're going to start discussing with you of these new interactions with AMI, time-dependent rates, time-of-use rates, and any other programs that we can do with, you know, talking to people's cars or whatever.
St. Jason's got something to say.
I just had some quick
comment. Introduce yourself, Jason.
Yeah, Jason Zyskowski, Chief Energy Resource Officer. And just one quick comment on your previous question about the historically, has the, we looked at the COSA. I'd say back to 2017, you can see where that was factored in there, further back than that. One thing I will note is, you know, I think it was for 4 years, we didn't have a rate increase. So in those years, there was no kind of incremental adjustments for alignment with the COSA. And that could have led to a little more misalignment with the COSA, you know, kind of right now. So.
Yeah, it's best practice to do a COSA every year, even if you don't need a system average rate increase, because you can see those misalignments and you may want to at least know that that's happening and maybe make rate adjustments, even if it's a system neutral kind of thing. And it does not look like that was done between 2017 and 2022. That is probably very much a contributor to where we are today.
Yeah.
Okay. Regarding distribution costs, we hear a lot about the need for and the planning for increased build-out of transmission. So we may be looking at bigger costs in the department classification of distribution.
Yes. If we end up needing to build a lot of T&D infrastructure, that will...
Or if BPA does, and yeah. Then we have to pay more to BPA.
Yeah, and so that, yes. These two boxes here, it just depends. And again, I'm going to beat our, I don't know if it's a dead horse, a live horse, a race horse. That's another part of what we're trying to do with the time reviews, the AMI, all those kind of things.
Yeah, and to Christina's point, AMI will be a game changer, as you all know, both from different rate designs and rate schedules that we can use to try to change behaviors and reduce the peak need, but also just to have that data and have that intel to confirm what we have, you know, monthly intel. On from our customers and when are they turning on their lights, when are they, you know, cooking breakfast, when are they doing things. So it's a combination of both having that intel and also then having the ability to offer different rate structures that can move people off that peak.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a challenge. I certainly, when I did the time of rate pilot, I made no progress. I didn't really have if I didn't let my house cold, but I didn't really have a lot of load I could move around. And so it's going to be interesting. Now, if I had an electric car, it would be a real game changer, right? To charge that car and all these things. So it'll be interesting to see how customers. I know a lot of customers have spoken to me. They're worried that we're only going to put a time of day raise. I think people have come to other places and they felt like there's gotchas when the price of electricity goes up.
Peter's favorite topic.
Yeah, so I can say that we talked about doing opt-in to begin with, and we're really excited to kind of show you when we're ready to share that. But I think customers are going to be exciting, and we're going to give them a really nice offering for time of day. And we are thinking about customers with different types of loads, different types of usage patterns, and how that's going to fit within their lifestyle with this. And like I say, I think it's going to be a good fit for a lot of customers. And for those that aren't, we can continue to show them opportunities as electrification comes online too. So I'm really excited to share a lot more with you on that pretty soon with me.
Looking forward to it. Can you just advance slide 19? So, Commissioner, I don't know what your thoughts are. I guess I'm not concerned if we maintain a difference for residential that give them a discount. And I don't want the difference to get bigger, but I don't know, what are your thoughts about having, I can see them as the owners of the utility. The others I see
more customers, right?
You see the residential customers as the customers.
As the owners.
As the owners. I think we're all, every category is part owner.
Okay. How do you feel about having a
I mean, if
a disparate
they're buying, if they're customers, and they live in Snohomish County, and they can vote for the commissioners, then the owners of commission, owners of the PUD are those who vote for the commission and help guide.
Right, and they're all residents. They're not corporations from other states that have built big box stores. I guess I just think of the, you know, it was over 75 years ago, it was the residents that voted to have a PUD. And I'm glad they did, because it has made the cost of electricity less for everybody, all customer classes. And it doesn't bother me have them essentially underpaying by the coastal model. I just was trying to understand what your thoughts are.
Underpaid?
Well, right now they're underpaying by 10.2% relative to the cost of service.
We can't discriminate, right? So people who, this might be a very unpopular point of view, but if you choose the luxury of living 25 miles out, that's a luxury in a way.
That is a good point, because we don't charge them.
I know of one person who, I won't go into detail, but I know people who live way out, maybe don't want to pay more, but they need to pay more because they're causing the prices to go up.
But we don't.
Distribution.
Right. We don't do that. We don't charge them more.
Yeah.
We charge everybody the same.
I know, but
and that's what
might be balancing it better if we do this increase.
Yeah, we're not, this is not about within the class. So a residential who lives,
right,
you know, 4 blocks from the substation versus 4 miles versus 400 miles is not, you know, not this part of the discussion. Now, when we talk about some of the rate design elements, that's when different customers within the class can be affected. This is just between the different customer classes of residential, commercial, and industrial.
Any other questions?
Well, I appreciate the refinement of all of this. I mean, I do. And I think you're on the right track. I'm not an expert in this area, nor do we need to be, but we do need to be well informed. And so at this point, I appreciate what you've presented. And I hope that the time of use business can get better and better and better.
Yeah, I would just encourage the board to maybe give this some thought, or Sid's question, Commissioner Logan's question, some thought as we go into the next presentation from Christina and Peter. That's where we will really kind of dive in and apply philosophy and the principles that we both highlighted this morning. And I do see that as, you know, one of the board's key kind of roles is setting that guidance or affirming that guidance around the principles and the strategy. And so yeah, I think that's something that maybe we can have some more robust discussion about and make sure that we are all in alignment, you know, going forward to where these allocations need to be.
Well, lots to think about. I don't have all the answers to your questions, but I do like the idea of the causation being reflected in the pay, the cost of service, as a basic principle.
Yeah, agree.
Thank you. Thank you, commissioners.
Great presentation. Lots of great data. Thank you very much. It's been a great discussion. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I really do appreciate it.
Very nice. Very nice job.
Glad we have your expertise.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, that is it for reviews.
Okay, it is now 10:15 a.m. and we can recess into executive session to discuss current or potential litigation under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meeting Act. It's anticipated the executive session will last approximately 30 minutes and conclude at 10:45 a.m. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30.